We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
Hi, Michelle and Emily. It's Rosemary here. I just want to thank you for the very interesting stories you've told and the lovely way that you talk to people and your gentle and nice manner with people, I think goes a long way to healing. So thank you, and I look forward to hearing more shows. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rosemary, for being the very first patron to leave us a voice message. What fun! We're going to be replying to our voice messages in the podcast in 2020, so get leaving them ASAP, please. It couldn't be easier. If you have questions for our guests, we'll do our best to have them answered as well. Just be a patron. It's all you have to do. Follow the instructions there. Very, very easy. This is our last episode of Australian True Crime for 2019, unless you're a patron as well, in which case there'll be no disruption to programming whatsoever. So there are two more great reasons to become a patron for as little as $2 US a month, which we know is roughly 13,000 Australian. So just go to patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod, A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod. Okay, name game time. Ainsley, lovely name. Remember that chef, Ainsley? Whatever happened to him? I'm sure he's still kicking around. Good on him. He had, what's that stuff called? I don't know, products at the shops. Andrew Foote, any relation to Paul? The beautiful, beautiful man. Tundra Howe, oh, shut up. Did your parents call you Tundra? God, they're fabulous. Carol Jordan, Naomi McComb, Wendy Brassington, Rob Knox, Montana Monday. Mm-hmm. Lisa Scandens. No, sorry, Scaddens. Natasha Harvey, Tracy Wiseman, Bree Illisevs. Oh, I love Illisevs. Tessa, okay. Tessa K. Halmshaw. Or is it Tessa Cy Halmshaw? As in, it's like acai, as in acai bowl. Or is it acai bowl, you know? That food that everyone was eating about a year ago and you don't really see anymore. T, just the letter T. Mitch, Jan Dugina, Lavina McCormick, Rod Deary, Louise Deo, Deb Fran, Lane Woodruff, Stacey King, Matthew, just good old dependable Matthew, Rosie Jackson, Peter Evans, Patrick, just good old dependable Patrick, Karen Smith, Kate Elston, Emily, just good old Emily, Mike Oxmall, Karen Philpott, Jane Thorne, Kylie, with two E's, so I'm not going to call you good or old or dependable. You're a different cat, Kylie, and I love it. Amanda Loomis, Sam Cooney, Amanda McQuillan, Katrina Hawthorne, Lauren Willis. That's a kitten in the booth with me. Don't worry about that. That shush, you said you wanted to come. I Wunderbar. Yes, you are. Julie King and Brett Polinus. He was at our gig the other night with beautiful Sandra Pankhurst. Hi, Brett. Hi again. Good for you. Thanks for coming along. And hello, Kim in London. Okay, thank you to everybody. Merry Christmas if I don't chat with you again until that happens. All right, on with the show. Kitten, you said you wanted to come. Well, come on then, I'll put you out. Hang on, hang on. I told you it would be boring. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
There are key moments that will stay with me. Like I remember, like they were yesterday. I can remember Mum, Dad and Stacey, my sister, visiting me at the Ipswich Watch House. And, I'm in this dirty, dirty cell and the toilet's not working, there's flea-infested blankets. I mean, not saying it was prepared for me, but, it was, and all I had was this little hole in the door to go and converse with them, and they're saying everything's going to be fine, you know. And that stays with me forever because it was the first time that it really hit me that they were, you know, saying that I was the one that did it.
This is part two of our two-part special called Who Killed Leanne Holland? It's named after investigator Graham Crowley's excellent book and website. He's also working on a podcast series, which we will definitely feature here on Australian True Crime when it's ready. Last week, we spoke to author Robin Bowles, who includes the court case that saw Graham Stafford convicted of murdering the 12-year-old Queensland girl in her list of Australia's greatest miscarriages of justice. This week we hear from Graham Stafford himself, who served 15 years in prison for the murder he maintains he didn't commit. These days, Graham Stafford is still fighting to have the review of his case, promised by the then Queensland Police Commissioner Bob Atkins in 2010, made public. The review was completed in 2012, but since then, Stafford's been locked in a legal battle with the Queensland Police Service, who, for reasons best known to themselves, are trying to prevent its release. However, they did helpfully pass on a document they called a summary of the review to Channel 7's recently axed Sunday Night program earlier this year. It was that summary that Sunday Night used to justify their ambush of Graham Stafford.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Australian True Crime patrons will receive a dedicated episode in which Stafford talks about the ambush and in which we hear from his current partner, Jackie, over the Christmas break. But in this episode, we hear from Graham Stafford about the day Leanne walked away from her Ipswich home for the last time. We hear about Graham's life in prison, surrounded by child sex offenders, and about who could have killed Leanne if he didn't. We begin by asking Graham to tell us about the house he was sharing in September 1991 with his girlfriend, Melissa Holland, her father, Terry, and her little sister, Leanne.
The house we were living in at the time was, I guess, just an average house. It was weatherboard, it was a little bit run down sort of thing.
It's so hot, and no one in Brisbane had air conditioning ever, so no. It's just hot, and you've got your fans going in summer. And
but I mean, it was okay. I mean, I must admit, I was a little hesitant to move in with her father initially because I'd seen where they lived originally. It was like a squat. It was in Goodna. It was, you know, it was really run down, and it was bizarre because Melissa's room was like spotless. But the rest of the house, you know, had holes in the walls and things. And it's like a housing commission, obviously.
So I get the impression that their dad was struggling in the way that a lot of dads would have struggled in those days to be single parents. A lot of people still struggle to be single parents.
Yeah, well, he got left with three of them. And Leanne was still in nappies when his wife took off, you know, for whatever reason. I don't know her. I've never really had any conversation. Melissa never used to talk about her. So.
And Melissa sort of stepped in a lot of ways to raise Leanne.
Yeah.
So everyone's struggling, but it's a loving household. That's the impression I got.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that was your vibe when you moved in. So you weren't worried about living with him per se?
No, not at all, no. Just the conditions that, I mean, you know, the way I'd been brought up, what I'd been used to sort of thing, just didn't compare, you know. I mean, I'm not the tidiest person, but, you know.
And also your parents, right? Your parents are sweet, conservative English couple, would that be fair to say?
Working class, yeah. And they just, I mean, came from nothing and brought us out here and, you know, now they live on the sunny coast. Well, Mum lives on the sunny coast. Dad passed away a couple of years ago, but.
I reckon your mum would keep a very clean household.
She does.
Yes.
She does.
Nice hot dinner on the table every night. Probably a hot breakfast every day. Did you get a hot breakfast?
I think she's too busy going on the cruises at the
moment. Now? But she strikes me, when you were a kid.
But when I was young. Yeah.
She strikes me as that sort of lady to say, you can't leave the house without a nice warm breakfast. And
you call your lunch dinner and your dinner tea. My husband's British and my kids go, what? He goes, let's have some dinner. Mm-hmm. It's lunch.
So how did you meet Melissa? What was that relationship like?
Through work.
Yeah.
We worked together. Well, she was in the office and I was out in the on the plant. I used to build roller doors. And it's kind of awkward because I guess there was someone else I worked with that sort of had a couple of dalliances with, but she just never seemed to want to progress from that. So I guess I started looking around, and we had a Christmas party and got talking to her, and you know, maybe it was a bit of Dutch courage, I don't know. And just we went out.
Good old Christmas party hookup.
Pretty much, yeah.
Fantastic. And so you ended up living with her and her family and little Leanne. What sort of little sister was Leanne?
She was fine. Yeah, she was just...
She was a cheeky girl. I mean, like, she, again, reminds me a lot of myself at that age. Everything I hear and read about her, I think, yeah, I wasn't allowed to, probably the leverage that she was allowed at home in terms of coming home late or whatever. But in every other way, to me, I think
she was like. She was a good kid. I mean, she had a couple of friends that were probably a little bit sort of, you know, I'd be a bit... Yeah. Probably, again, just what I'm used to. I mean, my sister's same age and she had friends come around and they weren't the ones swearing and sort of, you know, sort of... That wasn't something, just the way we were brought up.
I did. I mean, I was probably brought up similar to you, but I had rough-head friends like that. I get all that.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, she liked music and we were all into music, you know.
Yeah.
We... took her to Kylie Minogue, the concert, back before Kylie Minogue was really cool.
Yeah. You and Melissa did. You went for a bit of locomotion
I took a friend with me as well. I thought, if I'm going to see Kylie Minogue, I'm going to have a mate. We're having a couple of drinks first. But we did. And the best part was we told Leanne that we were going to see a rock instead. So we fronted up to the entertainment centre and she's gone, is Kylie here? No, we're going on. Maybe, oh, geez, if we'd known, you know. And that's just the sort of, you know, thing we did.
That's beautiful. We must talk about the day that she disappeared because it's the biggest turning point in your life and her life and her family's lives. It's turned a lot of lives upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else was at work. Melissa and Dad had gone to work.
Yep.
You had a day off.
I lost a day off, yep.
Yeah, and she's bopping around on her school holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin says that you put more into that day off than most of us put into a work day. You just did so much.
Well, yeah, not really. I mean, I sort of knew I had things I wanted to get done. I wanted to fit the shock absorbers to the car and, you know. I mean, I'm always cleaning it, but we didn't have any facilities there to clean it, so I used to just run up to the car wash. So, yeah, I ran up to the car wash in the afternoon. Harking back to what we were talking about before, after the conversation regarding the hair dye, Leanne, as I say, spoke to her dad. I don't know what the conversation was, but basically she said she was going to the shops. I said, that's fine, and didn't really think anything of it. I mean, she was given a lot of leeway to sort of come and go. And that was probably one of the things that annoyed me because... Well, not so much that she was given the leeway, but quite often, you know, I'd get up in the morning to go to work and all the doors were open. Like, you know, I've never lived in a house like that, you know. We have security and I'm shocking like that at home now, you know. I'm really, I've run on top of security, but you'd walk around and all the doors in the house would be open, you know. And it might be because she's gone downstairs to see her dad and left them open when she's come back up or whatever, you know. And that sort of got me. But so as far as I knew, she'd gone down the shops. It wasn't until many years later that we found out she'd actually spoken to the next-door neighbours before she went down the shops. I think that was when Crowley managed to prise the police job logs out of their hands, because initially I put in for them through FOI and they wouldn't let me have them, because I wasn't allowed to be privy to how a police investigation was run. So Crowley said, well, I'm an ex-police officer, or I think he was ex-police officer. So he knew how it was run, and he actually got hold of those job logs and found out that there were so many people that had seen her on the day.
So as far as you knew, she said to you, I'm going to the shops mm-hmm. to dye my hair. You said, fine, see you later. Roughly what time?
About 9:30.
Oh, early.
Yeah.
In the morning.
Yeah.
And that's the last you saw over that day, or ever.
Mm-hmm.
So what did she say? Was there anything significant in the chats with the neighbours that you found out much later, or just the fact that they had seen her and not been questioned?
Just that, from what Crowley, because he took a, I think they were Vietnamese So he took an interpreter. I mean, you know, I sort of had brief, hi, how are you going conversations, but never really got to know them well. But apparently they were planting a mango tree or something rather in the front yard. That's when they saw me working on the car later. But they'd also spoke to Leanne, and then she said she was going down the shops and they didn't see a return. This is, like I say, around 9, 9:30. I'm working on the car somewhere around 10:30 later that day, and they still hadn't sort of, you know, finished doing it. They were still planting in the garden.
They're still in the front yard and they haven't seen her come back?
It's such a normal suburban scene.
Yes.
Like just...
In
you
fact,
know,
even I've got Vietnamese neighbours and they're constantly farming the front yard,
yeah.
Even that.
And it's, yeah, just yeah. The horror that was to come.
Yeah.
It just, it, I don't know, just striking, really striking to me.
And it adds to the literal unbelievability of what was transpiring, that you are such normal people and this extraordinarily horrible thing happened to all of you. So when did people start to say, where's Leanne?
Tuesday. I think the problem we had was that because her dad had his own little area downstairs, and I don't know whether you've seen photos of the house, but you can't actually see whether he's in or not. So if Leanne was staying down with him, which she quite often did, she'd stay downstairs, you know, watching TV or whatever. I guess we probably just assumed she was downstairs when she could have been, he might have assumed she was upstairs. And it wasn't until Tuesday that we sort of realised, hang on, no one's seen her. And
so Tuesday was the next day. It was suddenly say, have you seen Leanne? Have you seen Leanne? And start calling around.
Yeah.
When were you worried?
Tuesday afternoon.
Tuesday afternoon. So you'd rung friends. Everyone
yeah.
had rung friends by that
yeah,
stage.
Yeah, well, we'd actually driven around to... we'd driven around to the caravan park where her best friend was staying, and she said she hadn't seen her. And then a few other places. That's when we went down the police station.
What was their attitude initially, police? Do you remember?
When we went down to report her missing?
Mm.
Just, yeah, okay, give us a few details. I think... I can't remember, but I think there was like a... They said there was a set period before they could sort of step in and say that she's actually missing.
Which yeah. now is sort of
not
you know,
yeah.
not done. But
now,
you hear that so much, they're like, oh, wait, they'll come back. They've just run away, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
How many days were you guys waiting before you knew the worst had happened?
I think they found her on the Thursday afternoon.
On the Thursday afternoon, I guess everyone stay home for these days and wait for news and all that sort of stuff?
I was actually, because they came up on the Wednesday and, you know, I'd sort of been down the police station for several hours. They were asking me things, oh, my movements, obviously, and whatnot.
Were they asking everyone that or did they single you out early?
No,
that?
No, they were asking myself and Melissa and Terry.
Yeah.
But I guess, obviously... You know, they were both working that day, whereas I was on a roster day off, so it was probably a little harder to sort of just say, well, this is where I was. Trying to remember everything I did, you know, I mean, don't think I even wore a watch in those
days. I often think that. I think I would have no idea what I was doing 2 days ago.
I don't know
even.
What I do on the weekend on Monday when people go, what did you do? I'm like,
And particularly if they'd sit you and ask you again and again, okay, go through it again.
Yeah.
Okay, Graham, tell me again, what were you doing on Monday?
One of the officers is called Graham as well, which didn't help. And it's like so confusing. The only thing that I got wrong, I told them on the Wednesday, I think, that I'd hurt my arm because when I was fitting the shock absorbers, I had the jack under it sort of thing because it was lowered, so I had to jack it up. And it sort of slid because I had it on this board. And it didn't fall, but it slid down and it just sort of jammed my elbow in the guard. And it sort of, you know, gave me a bit of grief. So I'd seen the first aid officer at work about it and it still gave me grief. So I actually went to the doctors. And when I was giving a statement, that was the one thing I got wrong, saying that I'd gone on the Tuesday, not the Wednesday, I think, or something. Monday, not the Tuesday. That's what it was. Even now I can't get it right.
Yeah.
And they made such a big deal of it, but it was me that pointed it out to them the next day. I said I was wrong. That was the only thing I got wrong.
Did you ever, in those first days, did you feel like they might have been looking at you?
Oh, after they took my car.
When did they take your car?
On the Wednesday.
So, okay, so Tuesday she's reported missing and on the Wednesday they took your car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Did you think, oh, yeah, it's reasonable they're going to interview me because, you know, that's just how it goes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, is it unfolded?
I mean, you know, we went down there voluntarily, you know, I mean, it's, yeah, that's the sort of thing you would expect that they're going to ask, well, when did you last see her and what were you doing?
Yeah, and, you know, as we look, we know from, you know, different cases and what, I guess, watching TV and movies, they will look at the people closest to the person, so.
And did you feel, people who end up wrongly convicted often talk about this feeling of, it's going to be fine, I haven't done anything, how can it possibly, was that your feeling? Were you afraid or were you feeling like it'll sort itself out?
No, I think, well, to give you an insight, I mean, when I was arrested, mum and dad, good old mum and dad, sort of racing around trying to get some legal advice. The only lawyer we knew was a real estate lawyer, and that's who we went with to begin with, you know,
yeah.
Sort of like a real estate lawyer. I'm thinking, well, it's going to sort itself out.
Yeah.
And basically he said, oh, just tell him to tell the truth. Yeah, it'll be fine, you know, and it's like, okay, you know.
Yeah, just tell the truth. You've got nothing to hide.
Yeah.
What can go wrong? So,
and I was naive. I had no idea, like, you know, they go on about your rights and whatnot. I had no idea that they had to record these interviews, and they weren't.
I don't think I would know that either.
No.
Yeah. Apparently, that's a big no-no.
So they didn't. Obviously, they didn't record your interview.
Not the initial ones.
Yeah. On Thursday, Leanne's remains were found. Do you remember when you heard about that?
I do. I can remember it. That's something that never leaves, you know. I mean, we were downstairs. her brother was there as well. And when they came in and said that they'd found her, I remember him punching this concrete post. It must have gone close to breaking his wrist. He was that upset, you know. And, I was upset. I had to ring you. Dad? It's just really, you know, I mean, it's bad enough that there are people, and there's probably always going to be, you know, as long as I live now, there's probably going to be people that are going to say, oh, he's guilty, you know, and that's, you know, tough enough, but it's just sad that they don't want transparency. They don't want to, get it all out in the open. You know? If what they're saying, what the police are saying is, if this review vindicates them, then why are they spending ginormous amounts of money in preventing it being released? You know? I mean, that last court case, they had to pay my legal costs, which was in excess of $50,000.
So why does it, when we talk about the moment that you heard about Leanne's remains being found, it's very upsetting, comes straight back to you, that feeling in that moment. And why does it then take you straight to the police and their attitudes about the information? What's the link there to you?
Well, just with everything that I know now, like I say, I didn't know anything about the next door neighbours, not being called, their statement being whatever they did with it, I don't know. I've actually got a heap of paperwork, you know, it's all random sort of printouts sort of thing, but from the police job logs, and it clearly shows they'd gone to the next door neighbours and it just says, oh, yeah, they were at a funeral and of no assistance. Well, how, you know, I know so much about what they did during that investigation now that it...
Does it take you straight to the next steps when you go back to that moment of hearing that she had been murdered, does it immediately take you to everything that then came after that?
It does. I mean, that in some ways, that's probably one of the worst. Well, obviously, it's one of the worst moments is when we found out that she was, you know, they found her body.
She's dead. She's never coming back. No. She's not at a friend's house. She's not run away. The worst has actually happened. Yeah. Unbelievable.
That probably stays with me more so than, you know, I mean, there are key moments that will stay with me. Like I remember, like they were yesterday. Yeah. I can remember Mum, Dad and Stacey, my sister, visiting me at the Ipswich Watch House. And, you know, I'm in this dirty, dirty cell and the toilet's not working. There's flea-infested blankets. I mean, I'm not saying it was prepared for me, but, you know, it was, and all I had was this little hole in the door to go and converse with them, and they're saying everything's going to be fine, you know. And that stays with me forever because it sort of, it was the first time that it really hit me that they were, you know, saying that I was the one that did it.
Yeah, and did something so heinous that that they're going to let you know from the minute you're in custody that this is how we treat people who do things like that.
Mm.
Well, you must have been terribly afraid in there.
I was, yeah.
When did you find out about the injuries that Leanne had sustained?
That wouldn't have been until at the trial.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I didn't have any real legal connection, representation. I had Adrian Gundelach, who was a good barrister at the committal, and I never really got to see him, but he, you know, obviously he's a good barrister. But when I came to trial, there was another trial, and whether it was, again, purposeful or not, I don't know. There was another trial he had to do, so he couldn't represent me, and I had been given a legal aid barrister by the name of Charlie Clark, who'd never handled a serious case and had 3 days to go through it all.
My God.
It's all very scary.
Then the reason I raise the issue of Leanne's injuries is because it's such a hideous attack. It's so brutal that for people to think that you did that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was probably when they started talking about her injuries, you know, saying that she'd been burnt with cigarettes. And that's when it sort of made me think back to when I was being interviewed. They kept offering me cigarettes and I said, I don't smoke, never have. Yeah. When people say, oh, you don't smoke, I usually joke and say I was always worried it would stump my growth, you know.
Because you're quite little. Yes. Yeah. And to find, you found that out in court? Her injuries were? God, what a horrible moment.
Mm-hmm.
For so many reasons.
And I couldn't find, I was looking through the transcripts, I was trying to find where they were talking about that because the judge did say, well, this guy doesn't smoke. And the prosecutor turned around and said, well, maybe he used the cigarette lighter out of the car. And the judge sort of said, well, is there any evidence of that? Well, no. He says, well, then probably should leave that alone then, you know. Mm. And it's like, well, where is all this coming from, you know? I mean,
so when did you start to think maybe I could get done for this? Like, you know, from that moment from thinking, well, I can't get done for this because I didn't do it. When did you start to think I could actually get done for this?
I certainly didn't think I was going to be found guilty. Even with some of the things they were saying, I thought, no, surely they're going to see through this, you know. Just, I don't know, different things. Like I think one of the witnesses who I supposedly identified in my car got the identification of the car down pat so good that the judge asked when she'd last seen the car, and she actually told him that she'd been shown a photo of it outside the courtroom by Detective Graham Richards.
Before she testified?
Before she testified. Her statement refers to a brown, rusty old car, not a bright red Gemini with a little sticker, O'Neill sticker on the windscreen.
No, there's one thing you're famous for. It's the condition of your car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Our patrons will continue to receive a brand new episode every week over the Christmas break, including a special one with Narelle Fraser and her favourite boss, Lorraine Blackwell.
I went to the academy in the 70s and I said to Narelle, it was only ever going to get better because for the first time in my life I had running hot water. Like, I grew up with no electricity, no running hot water. So you get to the police academy and you've got running hot water and a shower. Like, life doesn't get better than that.
Patrons will also receive another episode featuring Graham Stafford and his current partner, Jackie.
Mum wasn't overly impressed to begin with because I'd had a couple of pretty ordinary sort of attempts at relationships prior to that. Yeah. And again, some of those were people that I knew prior to.
But maybe you should have left them alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, say it like it is.
Well, say it like a current partner, yeah. Maybe you should have left that alone.
You can become a patron for as little as $2 a month US at patreon.com/austruecrimepod. Coming up on Australian True Crime, if Graham Stafford didn't kill Leanne Holland, who did? But first, Graham talks about his experiences in Queensland's prisons.
Bogger Road was pretty bad.
Were you in Bogger Road? I wouldn't have thought, of course. I'm just trying to think, when did they shut Bogger Road?
Yeah, it was. I was lucky because it was just on the... Yeah,
so lucky.
In the respect that it was at the point of closing.
Yeah.
But
so Bogger Road, we went through Pentridge recently, but Bogger Road was same vintage prison, but smaller. Victorian, smaller, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe lucky was the wrong choice of words. I can remember getting out of the... It's funny, I just go back to the watch house. When I got in the bus to go to Bogger Road, the irony was one of the guys that had been picked up was a guy I went to school with. And he's going, "Hey, Graham, what are you doing here?" Sort of, and we're chatting away. And then...
Fancy meeting you here.
After we got out at the police station, and I don't know whether that was when they did all the fingerprints and whatnot, and got back in, obviously... I'd seen Fiennes Clinton, the other detective, pull him aside when we were going in, and he just never said boo to me then. It was like, yeah, don't talk to him sort of thing, you know, which was,
Your old mate never spoke to you again.
Yeah, old school mate, yeah. But, yeah, once we got to Bogger Road, I mean, after you sort of had the shower, because you're in the back, you're segregated from everybody else, but there's only like a wire cage, so you can't sort of stop all the spitting and all that sort of stuff. And
why were you segregated? As a newcomer or as an offender who had been convicted for that kind of crime?
That wasn't a conviction stage. That was just an arrest stage. Okay. So then we go to Bogger Road and obviously there's like the jail grapevine obviously knows who's here sort of thing because you can hear them all yelling from the cages and whatnot.
So you're a rock spider in their eyes, and is that why you were segregated in that part?
Yep.
Okay. So you're with sex offenders. You're housed with child sex offenders.
Yep.
For Graham Stafford from his nice family in Brisbane, his lovely clean home. How was that? What are your recollections of that?
I can recall being locked in the cell and on the hour, every hour, whoever it was, probably the same officers, whatever, would come around and kick the door so that I couldn't sleep. I think that's probably when I first had the breakdown because, it was just... And obviously the food, I mean, they kept presenting me with food that couldn't be eaten. There was glass, wire... Other unmentionables, you could see it in the food, and I thought, well, I'm not eating that. So at that point, I think they realised, and I don't know whether that was going to be the case anyway, but they transferred me to Moreton Correctional Centre at Wacol, which, again, was protection prison. When I first got there, I was in a little old yard called Four Yard. I think it was 14, 16 inmates. And being who I was, I didn't know the likes of Barry Watts, Barry Hadlow and all these people, and it's like, okay, yeah, they seem all right. And then you start to sort of like get to know who they are, and it's like, really? This is where I am? Yeah. And yeah.
So your house with really the most notorious.
Well, Barry Watts, we've spoken about recently, just personally, Emily and I, about the fact that we wanted to cover the case because as a kid, the Sian Kingy abduction and murder by Barry Watts and his wife, Valmé Beck, was just a huge, terrifying story for us in Queensland, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That a woman could be involved in
absolutely
assisting her husband to abduct a child and rape and murder her. And you find yourself living with these people, which suggests to the rest of society that you are one of those people.
Yeah.
And then with this, from this perspective, you have to go to trial, right? So you haven't even been to trial still yet when you're in Wakehall?
Still in Wakehall, yeah.
So you have to try and summon the courage to go through and put your best foot forward in this murder trial. How were you by the time, you said you've already had a breakdown by this stage. How were you psychologically and emotionally by the time you came to trial?
Oh, I was a mess. I had, you know, had no real sort of plan of action sort of thing. I didn't sort of, there were basic things that I couldn't remember and I'd remember them years later. I'm thinking, well, how did I not, you know, why didn't I say that, you know?
Oh, and I just can't imagine the panic and the fear and how that could immobilize you and your mind. So you felt, you still didn't think though that you'd be found guilty throughout the course of the trial?
No.
Do you remember the moment when you heard the guilty verdict?
I do.
Talk us through that.
I still hear the scream from the back and I can remember hearing about them walking out of the court. They were told to go out the back way to avoid the media. The police let the media know where they were and come around and they're in their face. That was the photo that was in the Courier Mail.
What happens to you though? Like we have the literal saying of he's going down, because in England, in the old courts, they take them downstairs. Does that happen here?
Yeah. You go downstairs and you put in a cage and you just sit there for however long and just, you know, have to think about what's happened, and then eventually they'll put you in a paddy wagon and take you back to the jail. You then put on suicide watch for several days. Yeah, it's...
Did you think then, still think like it'll right itself, or did you at any point just give into it and say, okay, well, I've got 15 years or whatever it is?
I think after the second appeal, I think the one where... Fitzgerald, I think, said should have gone back, and the other two disagreed. It was ironic because they don't normally let people attend those, well, people, you know, us people, attend those court hearings. But I was there and I could actually see, I think it was Justice Davies, and he's laying back in his seat like this, and it's like, this is supposed to be a proper hearing and you just don't seem to be listening, you know. And then the other one... Justice, I can't think of his name, he was really old, and he starts bringing up how Leanne's hair's been dyed Titian again. I'm thinking, oh, that's another different colour, you know, it's like, and, you know, I just, yeah, I couldn't believe that. I thought after that one, when we lost that, I just sort of thought, well, I've got to try and stay sane and just keep going. I sort of already gathered from the people around me that... the fact that what I was charged with, what I was, the lifetime sentence I was serving, that was it. I wasn't getting out. And there were people that I sort of got to know that had been in there 30 and 40 years. Yeah, same sort of thing. And I thought, well, and I never really told Mum and Dad about that, because obviously, you know, they were still trying to, you know, help out. I had a visit every week, well, twice every week while I was at Wakehall or Moreton for 8.5 years off either, well, Mum and Dad would come every week, obviously, and Stace and whatnot, and then somebody else would come. And it was a case of they'd have to do it on a rota basis.
Because so many people wanted to come.
Yeah.
And I was very, surprised, not surprised by it, but sort of felt supported by it.
You do hear a lot, don't you, about prisoners, they're just, the people who visit them just drop right off.
Yeah, no, I had visits.
Well, so what did your life turn into? You did most of your time at Wacol?
I did 8.5 years at Moreton, yeah. Although, well, so I say 8.5, it was interspersed with the little time that I had at Arthur Gorry. And that's where things got a little bit pear-shaped. Private jail, they had no idea how to run things. And I got beaten up pretty badly. And it was pretty much arranged that I was going to be beaten up.
By whom?
Well, the staff in the fishbowl made no attempt to prevent the bashing in the cell next to me. Someone else was bashed prior to that, and he actually got to the intercom and called for help, and still they didn't come.
Was he also convicted of a sex offence against a child?
Yeah.
So you're still in protective custody, but it's not quite so protective at Arthur Gorry?
No, it was pretty... That was when Bogger Road was completely closed, and it was a case of half of them, let's put them in the same and see how it goes.
Oh, and that's how it went.
Mm. So I was taken to hospital. In fact, I got to the hospital before I realised I'd actually left the jail. I was that sort of, I remember the prison, the dog squad guy saying, oh, at least we know what size shoes they wear, because the shoe prints were all over my back. Yeah, fractured cheekbone, a few other things, and Mum ringing up saying, what's going on in there? And she actually got me complained enough for them to send me back to Moreton, unfortunately. Because, Moreton seemed to be a lot better run. The staff were better trained.
Good on your mum.
Our mums.
Yeah. I'm so glad she was able to do that, because as a mother, of course, that's your reaction when you hear that's happened to your son.
I won't mention the guy's name, but when I was recovering from my injuries and I hadn't actually left Arthur Gorry, the one of the head honchos, I won't say what his position is in case he's listening, but he basically told me that I should not press charges unless I wanted to go back and they'd do the job properly. Yeah.
So when did you... Let's talk about when you were getting close to the end of your incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was that feeling like? Did you...
Well, I was at Palin Creek when...
What's that?
Palin Creek is a farm.
So that's the kind of prison you go to when you're just about to...
It's a low-level farm. I mean, when I first went down there, it was very low security, but slowly but surely I think they've sort of sent the wrong kind of people down there occasionally, and there's been a few people run off because it was, as you say, low security. There were no screens on the doors or windows or anything. It was for people that were trusted.
Yeah, and transitioning back into society. Did you ever have any charges or anything while you were in prison?
None.
Trouble?
No. None whatsoever.
So you're in the farm environment transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
Do they give you programs? Like, what do they do to try and help you?
While I was in secure, they had a lot of computer programs, which I did a lot of those. There's cognitive skills. There's, I think they had, one of the best ones was an outside one that was alternate to violence. That was quite interesting, even though I, didn't really, it was run by outsiders, like I say, and it was just a totally different approach, I guess, sort of thing. But there's all sorts of programs being run if you want them.
Yeah, because I'd be intimidated to come back into society. Like, we've had a guy tell us that coming out of jail, the thing that rattled him the most was people, strangers smiling at him in the street. He found that really weird for a long time because it just didn't happen in jail.
I can remember when I first got to the halfway house at South Brisbane, they used to, they got you a job, so I'd have to travel on the train from South Brisbane to Central, and then from Central all the way down to Strathpine. And so you sort of be seeing a lot of people, and it just felt like everybody's gone, I know you. Yeah, I know. And
well, yeah, you were quite famous.
Even today, people still look at him funny and he goes, oh, yeah, I'm getting the look.
But do you think they know who you are? Because people look at me funny and I think most of them don't know who I am, but they just think she looks familiar.
She looks familiar, yeah.
So do you think maybe it's that in your case?
Well, it's possible. I mean, I've been fortunate because quite often it's been a positive response.
They want to give him a hug, or they want to shake his hand, or they give us money to buy a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
That's so Queensland.
I don't. That doesn't happen in Melbourne much, I don't reckon.
I don't think so. But again, I don't know. You know, Graham, you are such a high-profile case. And again, we're talking about a state where people, I'm not going to say don't, but certainly historically haven't had a lot of faith in police. And it might not be so difficult for them to imagine that you were wrongfully convicted and spent years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand how you would get a lot of positive feedback.
Yeah.
Which leads us all to, so you were released from prison. I mean, if you didn't kill Leanne Holland, who did? The attack itself was so violent and brutal. Robin Bowles says attackers when she talks about the attack on Leanne, which leads me to believe that she thinks it was more than one person.
Yeah. I haven't had it confirmed, but it's believed that that's what the review alludes to, the possibility that it had to be two people.
The famous executive report.
Yeah.
The review that you're trying to get access to.
See, and another thing that people sort of don't think about, and I've sort of spoken on our group page that we've got about it, is Leanne was probably taller than me. I was only, at that stage, I think 55 kilo ringing wet. I think Leanne was probably about 47, something like that. So that's not much, you know, difference in weight to, like, carrying your own.
You're right. Having never met you before, I didn't realise that you were
so short.
How tall are you, Graham?
I'm 5'2".
I never occurred to me that physically you'd be quite similar, actually, in stature. If not, she's a little bit taller.
Yeah.
You weigh a little bit more. And certainly the attack on Leanne, the injuries suggest an overwhelming attack on this young woman or this girl.
This is the thing I don't understand. I mean, that would have had to have been, you know, if one person was involved, then there's got to be some sort of, like, there was
restraint.
Yeah, there's no defensive wounds or whatever, you know, sort of scratches, whatever, nothing.
On you?
I had same clothes on me all day, nothing. I mean, they took all my clothes. I actually found, I was looking through stuff, as I say, and I found where I think Craig Holland, the brother, gave a statement saying that he noted that Melissa and I weren't at the house after Wednesday, and it's been reported wrongly that we had unfettered access to the house, which is somehow saying that I must have had more time to clean up, whatever sort of thing. But as of Wednesday, I had no car, no clothes, nothing. So we basically had to, and that's why I went and stayed with Jack's dad.
Right.
I had nothing at all, you know.
So even though Leanne had defence wounds, which showed that she had fought hard for her life, you had no wounds, no scratch marks or anything on your body.
Nothing. I was actually in Foyard when, I think it was 11 days later, when Julianne Lowe was murdered by Sean McFedrin. And this was at the caravan park where we thought Leanne had gone, her friend Trish lived. You know, looking back now, I mean, I don't know, can't say. I mean, he's obviously not the full quid. I've met the guy. I was incarcerated with him for a long time. I did ask him on one occasion if he knew Leanne. He said he didn't, which we knew wasn't true because he used to play. He's 19-year-old at the time. He used to play football with Trish and Leanne. That was from Trish's statement.
What about Leanne's sister, your former girlfriend, Melissa? Did your relationship continue at all after your arrest?
Pretty much, she sort of... I mean, she sent Mum a letter saying that she didn't believe it. She was supportive, but that her dad had told her not to have any contact because there might be suggestions that she was involved. So,
I mean, as heartbreaking as that is, it's like they've been through the biggest trauma of their lives too.
And that's you know, something that I don't sort of disregard. You know, it's something I think about. I mean, I'm pushing for this to be resolved, knowing full well that there's the other side of this, you know.
But you've gone from being a family member, part of the family that this tragedy's happened to,
yeah,
to being rejected by the rest of them, and that's very painful, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, it is, to the extent that she's sort of probably in a position to have an opinion and not express it.
Now?
She's never been vocal about it. I've never sort of... I mean, a friend of ours, the friends that we were down the coast with on the weekend prior to all this happening, her daughter and Melissa's sons used to go to the same school, so they'd bump into each other.
Mm.
And one day it just came up in conversation. Melissa said to Mandy, "So who do you still catch up with from the old days?" I mean, really? You can't ask that question and not sort of think... And she was obviously fishing, yeah, to see if we were still... And we, you know, she says, "Oh, yeah, I still catch... You know, we still see Froggy all the time. That's my old nickname that never seems to die, you know." I don't know where that came from. But, you know. Yeah, so... And she didn't sort of say anything of it. She didn't get nasty or anything. Didn't bag me. So I'm thinking, well, you know... I mean, if there is to be any sort of conversation between the two of us, I guess it's got to come from her. I can't be the one approaching her because that would be seen as, you know, it could be turned into something else other than just me wanting to know what she thinks or what went on.
Is Terry still living, their dad?
No, Terry passed away a couple of years ago.
And her brother?
Her brother passed away...
So there's only Melissa
left.
Left.
If you have any information regarding Leanne's murder, please call Crime Stoppers in your state or contact Graham Crowley at whokilledleanneholland.com. You'll find that link on our social media pages and in the show notes to this episode. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back on the 9th of January 2020.